Thank you. And I'll begin, as I always do. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Nestor Benjamin Zapata. My first name is Greek, my middle name is Jewish, my last name is Mexican, and I'm Puerto Rican. So you accept me. That's cool. This is really an honor for me to be standing here before you. My anniversary is January 6, 1979, and I haven't had a drink since. I came in 1956. You remember that year, A.D.? And I stayed for 4 months, and I left because I was too young. I was in college. I had a car. I was working. I wasn't Irish, so how the hell could I be an alcoholic? I mean, that's called denial. And I want to thank GSO for giving me the honor to speak here. I am blessed twice over because I'm here with my wife, and I'm here with my son. And he's got 10 years. I'll tell you briefly what happened, how it was, and how it is today. I was born in Puerto Rico, and my father died when I was 3 years old. He died on Mother's Day, May 10th, 1935. AA started June 10th, 1935. And soon thereafter, my mother abandoned me and left me to live with my grandparents. So here it was like the Hatfields and the McCoys. During the day, I spent time with my grandparents, and as soon as it got dark, I'd go to my mother's house. And it was kind of rough because of all these feelings that I had even before I picked up a drink. And the reason I say that, because I was full of fear, anxiety, and I didn't understand it. I came to New York 7-8 years later, and I met my stepfather. My stepfather was a real nice, kind man. He was from Belgium, and he spoke 4 different languages. And I loved around the holidays because he invited his friends over, and they would drink sherry. So as a youngster, I would watch them drink from these little glasses of sherry, and they would offer me a little glass of sherry, and I said, "Oui," and I became a linguist. But that was the extent of my drinking. He died when I was 11 and a half, and all those feelings came up. And growing up, it wasn't easy. It was my mother, my sister, and I, and I always wanted to be accepted. I always wanted to belong, and I didn't know how to do it. So I was very good at sports. You know, I played baseball, football, basketball. I learned how to ice skate when I was 14 years old. I was the only Puerto Rican kid in the neighborhood that knew how to ice skate. To tell you the truth, I was the only Puerto Rican kid in the neighborhood, period. And it was great. And when I became 18, I got my first sponsor. It was the corner bar of 188th Street, and it was a bar league. And we had these beautiful white uniforms with green lettering. So on my birthday, I got to play second base. I became an instant hero. I got a couple of hits, made a couple of plays. And the owner took me to the bar, and he bought me a drink, and the older guys bought me a drink, and I felt I arrived. And the second week, I played again. I played great, and we went back to the bar, and the owner said, "Nestor, sit in the booth, watch the baseball game, and have soda pop. And before De Niro, you're talking to me? I got my draft card." He says, "Sit in the booth, drink soda pop, and watch TV." So I got my second resentment. And resentments followed all my drinking career. Now, around that time, after high school, the Korean War had broken out, and I wanted to escape my mother because she was very controlling. So I was waiting to get drafted into the Army. And I forget the year, but I got a letter one day, and I was reclassified 4F. That meant I wasn't good enough. And I drank over that, and I got pretty drunk. And I was very angry at that. And I'll never forget that a lot of the guys that I grew up with, that I played baseball and football and basketball, that I partied with, drank with, fought with, a lot of them were killed in Korea. And I went to visit every one of those guys. And it was nothing more devastating to go into a funeral parlor and mother or father would say, "Why are you still alive and my son is dead?" And I would bow my head and I would leave and I'd go to a bar and I'd have a drink. Because drinking saved me. It got me of all my troubles. I used to think that bartenders were the most brilliant people on earth. I'd go into a bar and I'd be feeling sorry for myself, and they said, Nesta, have a drink. Bingo, I'd have a drink, no more problems. And that was the extent of it. I kept on drinking. I was going to college at night, working. I met a gal in 1951. Didn't get married till 1958 because I believed in long engagements. I didn't want to rush into anything. And we were supposed to get married in 57, but a lamppost stopped that. I had been at the beach with her, and I took her home, and I went ahead and I went home, shaved, got dressed, went out dancing. I loved to dance. I used to do a lot of Latin dances. I wanted to be the first Puerto Rican Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire, but I drank too much. And that night I got pretty drunk, went to an after-hours joint, and I don't know, in the blackout I was on 149th Street and Southern Boulevard, and I passed out behind the wheel, and I took a lamppost down, and I went through the windshield of the car. And two policemen, to this day, I think they were in AA, they pulled me out and they said, I give this kid 48 hours to live. And I said the prayer that most of us one time or other have said, please God, get me out of this mess and I'll never drink again. And I know what a turkey feels like at Thanksgiving. Because the next day when I woke up, they told me they couldn't give me anything because I had a brain concussion. And the next day, the nurse gave me a mirror and says, here, look at yourself. And I looked like a mummy. The only thing I could see was a slit of my eyes and my mouth. They gave me 100 stitches in my head, 50 in my face, 50 in my leg, plus 8 busted ribs. And my friends came to visit me, and my friends were really nice. They said, Nesta, can we get you anything? And I said, yeah, get me a little pony. Now, for those of you who are not familiar what a pony is, it's those little airline bottles. And I'd have them underneath my pillow. So here I'm getting morphine to kill the pain and taking booze to kill the other pain. And that's where alcohol took me. I was transferred to another hospital, and I was there for 3 weeks, and I was on crutches and drinking. And one night, the doctor came, and he thought the stitches in my left leg had cleared, and he took the stitches out. But unfortunately, I have a vitamin K deficiency. I mean, I shave and I cut myself and I bleed like crazy. So the wound opened up during the night, and the head nurse, who happened to be a nun, came over to me, and the next thing I know, I'm half-bagged, and they gagged me, they tied me up, my legs, and the nun looked at me and said, our Savior suffered on the cross, and so do you, and proceeded to cauterize my left leg with a hot iron, and I passed out. And when I came to, I reached under my pillow, I got my bottle, and I drank it. And that's where booze took me. I was out of work for a while. I went back to school, and I kept on drinking. I got married July 13th, 1958. I was only late 20 minutes. I don't know why she made a big deal. I mean, I showed up, you know? You know, first things first was not one of my repertoire. You know, when I was asked about first things first, I thought about that, and to me that meant, if you're going out drinking, make sure you got enough money. That's what I think of first things first. Have money if you're going to drink. Anyway, I continued drinking. We got married. We moved to the Bronx. We had 4 kids, first 2 boys, then 2 girls. I had Planned Parenthood and drank a lot. And in 1960, I went to work for a major insurance company, and I had a manager that used to talk funny. He used to say things like, first things first, easy does it, it's a day at a time. It sounded good, but I didn't understand it. Then he asked me if I liked to read, and I said, oh, yeah. He says, sometimes my wife says that I'm drunk, and I recite to her the preamble of the Constitution or soliloquy from Hamlet, Macbeth, or Julius Caesar. And he said, oh, really? Well, here, memorize this prayer. So I memorized the prayer, but I said it differently. I used to say, God, grant me the serenity to expect the things I cannot change. I found out I was saying it wrong. And I continued drinking. On my birthday, June 28, 1976, we moved to a new community called Roosevelt Island. Now, for those of you who don't know where that is, it's in the middle of the East River. It's 800 feet wide. 2 miles long, and my brilliant wife thought that would stop me from drinking because there were no bars. So guess what I did? I joined the church group, the senior citizens, the little league. I got involved with politics. I went to parties. I told funny stories and got accepted all over again and drank. Unbeknown to me, I met a man who was to become my sponsor, and I used to go up to his house after Mass, and he wanted me to read from his atlas. Well, that's what I thought about it was, because he said it was his big book. And then I couldn't figure out, why would an attorney want me to read to him? So there I'd be on a Sunday morning, and Jim is going to love this. First I'd say, I'll read anything you want. First give me a double scotch, preferably Dewar's, a little water, and I'd be reading, really have a she in a person fail who has thoroughly followed up back. Doo-doo. I read the big book, the 12 and 12. He asked me what I thought about it. I said, it's got a lousy plot. It doesn't pertain to me. I'm not like those people. He said, Nestor, you're an alcoholic. I says, I'm not an alcoholic. He says, if you drink like you drink, you're an alcoholic. I says, I'm not that bad. And continued to drink. Then he said something that hurt. He said, maybe you haven't suffered enough. And I suffered. Because, folks, at the end of my drinking, I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't stay sober. Everything tasted the same. In November of that year, in 78, I wound up in a hospital and I talked myself to going home, and it was pretty sad. And I remember my last drunk. I don't remember my first drink. My last drunk was a half a gallon of Dewar's, of Gallo Port, and a fifth of Dewar's, and I couldn't get drunk. And I had invited myself to a party for the Feast of the Epiphany, Little Christmas, and my friend Tony said, you can't come to the party if you're drunk. And I said, I promise you, I won't be drunk. But the funny thing happened. My wife begged me to take a nap, and I fell asleep, and when I woke up, I felt all the shame and the guilt and the terror. The perspiration was coming out of me like a hot summer's day, and I could remember that August having to put 2 blankets on me because I got the chills. And that's where booze took me. And the next day, I called Tom and told him what had happened. And he said, you think you could not drink for one day? And I tried it. And I started my journey. He took me to Our Lady of Peace Church, which is now closing in New York City. And the reason I mention that is because I used to go to that church every night before I went home from work and pray and ask God to help me to stop drinking. And the moral of that story is I went upstairs to save my soul. I went downstairs to save my ass. And I started my journey. And there was a lady named Jane C., who's got 40-odd years, and she came up to me after the meeting and said, young man, I said, what do you want? Real arrogant. And she said, keep coming back. And I said, keep coming back to what? She said, you'll find out. So a day at a time, I don't drink, I don't think, I come to meetings and I've allowed the good things to happen. Now, I'm going to tell you briefly what happened to me if you're new or coming back. In my first year of sobriety, I was sober 2.5 months and wound up in the hospital with colon cancer and bleeding ulcers. My sponsor died on March 13th of that year of a heart attack. My grandmother, grandfather, and uncle and aunt died in Puerto Rico. 3 friends of mine that I grew up with died, 2 of them from alcoholism. My second son was hospitalized. And after 10 months of being sober, my wife handed me the divorce papers. And I didn't drink because I remembered what I was told. First things first. You take care of your sobriety, everything else will take care of itself. And in sobriety, I've had double knee operation. I've had the left knee done 3 more times. I had open heart surgery. I've had 4 stents. I had bladder cancer. I had prostate cancer. I've had rotator cuff. I just had my eyes done. I could see you because I don't need glasses anymore. And I didn't drink in spite of everything that's happened. Because if drinking is the answer, what is the question? And I'm a happy camper. You know, I've been blessed 10 times over. Last year, my second son called me up and said, Dad, I have some news for you. And he said, what is it? He says, you're a great grandfather. I says, Michael, I'm too young to be a great grandfather. He says, you're older than dirt. I haven't seen him yet, but I have pictures. I have 9 grandkids that never saw me drink, and 1 great-grandson. I have the love of AA and the love of God. And without AA, I don't have God. And without God, I don't have AA. I am so happy to be here in Silver. There are a lot of people here that I know from Cape Cod, from all over. I may not know all of you, but I know all of you. And in closing, I'd like to say that I asked God for grace, and He gave it to me. That's my wife's name. So you'll meet her one of these days. You'll probably see her later on. So I want to thank all of you for allowing me to share my experience, strength, and brain damage. Thank you.
Thank you, Nestor. And now we have Beth from North Carolina.
I put it there. My name is Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. Because of the grace of God and the steps and fellowship of AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since June 26, 1988. So I just celebrated an anniversary. I live in Cary, North Carolina, which they told me when I got there was the containment area for relocated Yankees, and Area 51. But I got sober in Area 56, Cincinnati, and they are in the house. So I'm going to get this out of the way because they all know, a lot of them were there when I got sober. So I just want to let you all know. They know. I was not somebody that walked through the doors of AA and said, thank God I'm home. I spent most of my childhood trying to get out of Ohio because I heard it was warm other places. And then I spent most of my adolescence trying to stay out of AA because my dad got sober when I was six. So I was familiar with, maybe I was seven. See, I'm lying already. But I knew AA worked. I had a sober parent in the house, which makes it harder to drink when you're a teenager. And I kind of did some drive-by AA. I was one of those ones who would go through treatment to stay out of jail and, I'd get out of treatment ready to stay sober forever. And I gave it a good 2 weeks every single time I got out of treatment. And nobody remembered my name. I probably didn't tell you my name. I came a minute before the meeting started. I was out the door. I never sat in the back because we know you're new if you sit in the back. So I kind of just hide in the middle and bail because I didn't. And then I was mad that nobody remembered my name. But when I got sober and stayed sober, several things happened. One, I was out of plans completely. And that's a good place to be if you're new, because if you still got a plan, you know, I always had a plan on how to do AA that was a little more convenient for me. So I was laying in detox at 29 and a half years old, and I realized I was distressingly healthy, and I had absolutely no plans for being 30 because I thought I'd be dead. So I was laying there kind of mulling my options and realized I had none. And I realized I wasn't going to die, that I was going to live to be 70 or 80, drinking or not drinking. A voice in my head just said, people like you don't die, Beth. You are going to just slog on to the bitter end. And that scared me. So this one little boy, I have many, a chorus of voices in my head still. They meet often. I try not to attend. But one voice in my head just said, you know, what you're doing is not working. And they're all staying sober, so maybe you should just do what they do. And I had no idea that was going to be the beginning. And I started going, I got sober at 405 Oak Street in Cincinnati, which is one of the oldest clubhouses. Yay! Oldest clubhouses in the country. And they had a big book meeting upstairs at noon every day that was cleverly named Noon Big Book. They read a whole chapter at a time. They didn't read all the steps and traditions and everything because they read a whole chapter. They read the first paragraph of the foreword of the first edition. You know, we are of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And then they would read the whole chapter, and there was still 20, 25 minutes left for discussion. So I went because I knew from my multiple trips through treatment that you should read your big book every day, and I thought that would count so I wouldn't have to read at home. Because if I read at home, I was staring at the same page for 20 minutes, or I was 20 pages in and had no idea what I read. And I went because my day was free at 1 o'clock then, you know, awesome. And I went because reading a whole chapter chewed up half of the hour, so maybe I wouldn't get called on. It didn't occur to me they didn't want my 3 days of experience, strength, and hope there. But God has a great sense of humor. And, you know, I didn't not believe in God when I got here, but I wasn't praying because I didn't want him to know where I was. And so, you know, I knew he did stuff for you, but I figured he was up there keeping score. But he's got a great sense of humor. And what happened as a result of going to this big book was my day was free at 1, but by 4 o'clock I'd remember I had no life, so I'd go back for another meeting. And chewing up the half of the hour did, you know, I didn't have to share, but I got to hear people. You know, the big joke on me was that people who go to big book meetings on purpose read the book and do what it says. And I had unwittingly plopped myself into the middle of the most active people in Cincinnati Alcoholics Anonymous. And many, many, many of those people who were in that meeting in 1988, they're still sober. I mean, how many new big book people are here? Yeah, I mean, it's just a great meeting. Some of us went to the Braves game that they didn't play on Wednesday night. And but there were 5 of us there who were in Seattle together. You know, it's just reading that book is, it's the way to go. It built that foundation that I stood on. And the other thing that happened was that about 3 weeks sober, I'd gone to work for my mom because she knew I wouldn't work at all if I didn't, and I was unemployable, so I was answering phones at her office. And I'd gone to Noon Big Book, and I was on my way back to her office, and I stopped at Walgreens to run an errand, and I popped up to see what everybody was talking about. You know, sometimes it's interesting. And somebody in my head was going, that was so cool what Guy said at the meeting. And somebody else is like, I know, I didn't even know that was in the book, did you? And somebody else is like, I didn't know that was in the book. And I just remember thinking, God, the voices in my head are getting sober. You know, it's like, it's a good sign if they're up there discussing the meeting without you. And but what these people taught me to do in that meeting were the things that I have stood on ever since. I mean, I got the basics, pray, read the big book, you know, get a sponsor. But the other things they taught me were things like 10 minutes early is on time, you know, and half an hour early is on time for your home group. And if you're late, slip in the back. Don't high-five everybody on the way to your seat in the front row, you know. And if you drink a lot, get 2 coffees before the meeting starts so that you don't have to get up and disturb everybody else. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I found out if I didn't get up for coffee 4 times during the meeting, I didn't have to get up twice to pee. And so, you know, we work with others. God first, AA second, each other third. Because if God is not first in my life, the rest of it's not there. And you know, Nestor referred to it that we have to take our own program first. And I kind of think of it as like when you're on a plane and they say, put your own oxygen mask on, because you cannot help anybody else if you're dead. And, you know, I met my husband in AA, a lot of you know him, and we based our relationship and our marriage on God first, AA second, each other third. And I, you know, on a good day, he is third. If I'm not thinking about me, and fourth is okay, it's still in the top 5, I figure, so he's good. But, you know, we have been through ups and downs. We had some trouble with our son when he was a teenager, and at that point we looked at our daughter who was in 7th grade and said, you've kind of coasted on our AA God up to now, but this stuff coming up is hard. It's going to be hard. And you need your own relationship with God. And we don't care if you go to Alateen or youth group at church, but you need to pick one. Because while we know we have to be there for you, we also know if we don't double down on AA, we can't be there for you either. And we just, you know, something would happen with our son, and we would just kind of audit, we'd be ready to kill, and then we go, maybe we should pray. And then we'd be less ready to kill, and we go, maybe we should call our sponsors. You know, and then later we'd be like, oh my God, God, AA, don't kill the kid. You know, it works. It really does. But I've been given a life beyond my wildest dreams. And there's, you know, they told me when I was new, and I believe it now, that there's no advanced Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I do the same things that stay sober now that I did when I was new. And you know, the early days took forever. That, like, from 6 months to 9 months is about 5 years, I think. And, you know, hitting the year was awesome. When I turned 2, I asked my grand sponsor why I was sicker now than I was last year. And she said, oh, you're not. You're just starting to notice. And I was like, oh, my God. Everybody else knows. She's, oh, yeah. You know. But I never would have told you when I walked in the door that I'd be standing anywhere 27 years sober, much less here. You know, I mean, Chuck and I have gotten to do amazing things. One of the things they say when you're new is, you know, if you make a list, you'll shortchange yourself. And I thought, it's so cliche when you're new, you know, easy does it. You know, if you make a list, but my list when I got here was I wanted my driver's license back. I wanted to stop getting arrested. And I maybe someday wanted to remarry, preferably to a guy that had a job. It never was important at last call. And, you know, Chuck and I will celebrate 23 years of marriage next week. And we have been, you know, we've been to New York City, we've been to the Keys, when we moved to North Carolina, we learned how to play golf and found out that Pinehurst was down the road and the U.S. Open was coming. So the next year, we're watching the U.S. Open. And all of a sudden, we're on the 18th green watching, you know, Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods. And sorry to you non-golfers, but the golfers are like, Pinehurst! But, you know, all of a sudden, we looked at each other and just started laughing. It's like, we're sitting on the 18th green at Pinehurst number 2 watching Tiger Woods. Like, this was so not on my list, you know? And we've been saying that ever since. I mean, I've been horseback riding in Iceland, you know, not on my list. Chuck and I got to go parasailing in Key West, not on our list. Never will be on our list again. bad time to remember you don't like Ferris wheels. And, you know, I've met people all over. There are friends here from all over the country. And, you know, I used to roll my eyes at people who said they were grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and that they had a life beyond their wildest dreams. And I got to tell you, you know, I have friends all over the country and I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And it's because of a foundation built on the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that took me to a relationship with God. I didn't have to find God in step 3. Step 12 said I found God as the result of these steps. So that's how I got there. And that is where I want to stay. This rocketed into the fourth dimension stuff is for real. And I am so glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth. And now, Jeff from the United Kingdom.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jeff, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is the 4th of November, 1979. And from here on in, I think you'll find my accent just a little different. But please don't let that worry you. I'm really pleased to be here, and it feels a real honour to be able to share my experience, strength and hope at this meeting, at the World Convention. It gives me a great buzz and a feeling of gratitude knowing that our fellowship is now 80 years old. I think that is absolutely fantastic that we're still going strong after all of this time. I do quite a lot of public information work as part of my service role, and I'm forever telling people out there that we are still going strong. You know, organisations spring up, organisations collapse, but AA still continues one day at a time. And I was thinking this morning that I feel so different to how I did when I first came into the fellowship, feeling absolutely desperate and hungover and disillusioned, and deep down I had this feeling of powerlessness. After trying and trying and trying to control my drinking and to stop it, I knew that I was beaten. I knew that I could not do it, and I found myself begging for help, and I phoned the helpline in Bristol in England, and somebody came around to see me in my own house. I noticed that one of the meetings at the convention is called 12-stepping in the old-fashioned way, and I'm pleased to say that I was 12-stepped in the old-fashioned way, because this guy, he even had the same name as me. How about that for the perfect 12-stepper? And he just simply sat down at my kitchen table, and we were drinking coffee, and he just spent about 5 or 10 minutes telling me about himself, and the identification was absolutely amazing. And although I haven't seen that guy for years and years and years, and sadly he didn't make it himself, he went out drinking again, I've no idea if he's dead or alive, but I'll always be grateful for what he did for me. He really was there when I needed the hand of AA. And that was the beginning for me. My drinking spanned about 24 years altogether before I eventually stopped. And I took my first drink at the age of 15. And I'll never forget the feeling that it gave me. I have to tell you, before then I felt pretty insecure, very inferior to everybody else, couldn't do relationships very well, thought that everybody was better than me, and I covered it all up with an air of bravado and arrogance. And when I took my first drink, it took all of those feelings away, it gave me a feeling that I'd never experienced before in my life, and I thought that it was absolutely fantastic. I got drunk on the first time I picked up a drink, and I drank myself into a blackout and did crazy things, and I had to be told the next day what I'd done. And really, that describes my drinking for the next 24 years. And I was a very destructive drinker. I caused a lot of chaos in other people's lives. I did a very responsible job. I was a nurse by profession, and I was responsible for other people's lives. And I was often drunk on duty, or I would leave work early so that I could go home to drink. Fortunately, nothing bad happened to the people who I was responsible for, but this was in the 60s, I got away with it time after time after time. Looking back, I deserved to be sacked several times over, but fortunately, I never was. And the reason for that is because people covered up for me, or I just kept out of the way when I knew that I would probably be caught. And I moved around the country. When I looked back, I realized that I was jumping before I was pushed. And I got married, I have a son from that marriage. But alcohol destroyed my first marriage. I met then the person who is still my wife. Actually, tomorrow, Independence Day, we're going to be celebrating 40 years of marriage. I mean, that really is a miracle, and it really is all down to the program my wife's amazing tolerance patience. I really do owe her a lot, because I know that she's had to put up with a fantastic amount of crap, and that's since I came into AA, by the way. And the drinking continued then for a while, and this marriage started to go the same way as the first marriage did. And then about a year before I came to the fellowship, I think the penny, or shall we say the cent, started to drop. I realised that I had a problem. And I tried so many different ways during that last year to do something about my drinking, and I couldn't. And my mood changed. I knew a lot of depression during that time. I was drinking on my own in the house when my wife went to work. I wasn't answering the door, nor the telephone, keeping the blinds closed, this sort of thing. Just wallowing in self-pity, really. And eventually I couldn't stand it anymore, and I phoned AA. And I'll never forget my first meeting. It was a very small meeting, a few miles outside of Bristol, in the southwest of England. And, you know, I knew that I was in the right place. Jeff, my 12th stepper, took me, and the identification that I got was tremendous. And actually, I know that this is first things first, and I will say something about that term shortly. The very first thing that I picked up at that meeting was one day at a time, you know, and that's still probably the most important AA slogan for me. You know, I was told that if I want to stay away from drinking, I was to do it for just one day. And that made sense to me. I didn't have to worry about tomorrow or what I was going to do at Christmas or what I was going to do at New Year or special events and this sort of thing. It was just for today. And that has worked for me ever since, I'm pleased to say, and I hope that it continues to do so. And gradually, I've learned to live my life that way as well. But coming on to first things first, you know, I know that people say it's a selfish program, and some people say it's not a selfish program, but I can understand what they say when they say it is, because it means that I've got to put myself first as far as my sobriety is concerned. Nobody else can do that for me. Only I can make that resolve when I wake up on the morning not to take a drink for that day. Nobody else can do that for me. But what I do know is that if I don't pick up that first drink and remember the spiritual tools that I've been given so freely from this program and go to regular meetings, I know that a day at a time I won't have to take a drink. And the very first thing I do when I get up out of bed on a morning, I did it this morning, was to have a shower and then sit in a period of meditation. And that really is my time when I'm completely alone with my higher power. And this discipline has been so important for me. I learned to meditate in my very early recovery. So I've been meditating for around 34 years now, most days in the morning. And that's really worked for me. I have to tell you that my head was absolutely crazy. It really was crazy. And I started to look at those when I was doing the fourth step with my sponsor and then sharing everything that I wrote down with my sponsor. And so much of my recovery has been about trying to keep my head reasonably clear, reasonably calm. Because, you see, after coming into the fellowship, I relapsed on two occasions. And the trigger for those relapses was anger. Pure, white, hot anger. For absolutely no reason at all. Stupid reasons. There isn't time to go into those reasons this morning. But the anger that I displayed and the destruction that I caused was totally disproportionate to what the trigger was. So I knew that these strong emotions had to be dealt with. Perhaps the main tool for me has been that of meditation. So this is how I begin my day. We had one daughter when we got shortly after we got married. She was affected by my drinking. I was still drinking then. But fortunately, she's okay now. She's straightened herself out. We had another daughter. I call her my sobriety baby. She's never known me drink. And the difference really is astonishing. I admire her so much. I do both of my daughters, actually. My son, sadly, is a drinking alcoholic. My brother is an alcoholic. In fact, he's in a home for people with dementia because he drunk himself into alcohol-induced dementia. And now it feels very, very humbling because I'm his attorney. I'm responsible for his affairs. It feels really weird going into his bank account so that I can do what is necessary for him. But there's a great feeling of gratitude as well. What's the difference between my brother and me? Well, I stopped drinking when I was 39, and my brother continued. So, you know, it really is a very, very hard lesson being reminded of what could well happen if I picked up a drink again. And, you know, the relationship between my wife and I has changed considerably over the years. We are both self-confessed control freaks, and you know, we've kind of had to work through our codependency issues. But the good thing is that we've done it. You know, as a result of working the program, we've done it. My wife isn't in the fellowship, but she's amazingly supportive, and she would be devastated if one day I said to her that I wasn't going to go to meetings anymore. And I was sat in the outside yesterday, soaking up the sun, and I realised that we are now spiritual partners. I realised that for the first time, and that feels really, really good to be able to relate to each other upon equal terms, rather than the one trying to control the other. No prizes for guessing that it was me who did most of the controlling. But I feel a lot easier about letting go now and letting things happen. So I think I'm just about ready to wind up now. So I'd like to thank you for listening to me. You know, I don't know any of you in this room at all, and yet I feel so connected to you. This is the beauty of our fellowship. You know, wherever I go in the world, this is my fourth international convention. You know, I know that the vast majority of people who I meet, I won't have seen them before, and yet I feel connected immediately. Where else can you get that sort of connection? I went into a social occasion last night, and I need to say that one of the things I've had to work on throughout my life, I've had a social phobia, where I found it very, very difficult to relate to people. It was awful before I came to the fellowship, but gradually it's got better in recovery. And I didn't know anybody else in this social occasion last night at all. There must have been about 50 people. And that old thing cropped up within me. I shouldn't be here. I'm out of place here. I want to escape. I want to go right now. And then there was another voice which said, "Jeff, you'll be all right. You're amongst your friends. You're with AA people. Sit down and just relax." And I did that. And I saw a guy on the other side of the table smiling at me. And he was from Switzerland. And we started to speak. And after that, I was engaged in conversation in the whole with the whole table. So I'm really pleased that I stayed. And I'm pleased to be with you all here this morning. Thank you.